Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.
Street Cop.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. Your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Pino. Today I have with me one of our future potential instructors. He is a retired, I don't know if I can say, can I say it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, retired New York State Trooper, Jeffrey Scholes, negotiator. I'll let him tell you and give you his 90-second biography of who he is.
Well, Dennis, thanks a lot for having me here, man. I'm really excited about it. It's great to be here. I really appreciate it. Like you said, I'm a retired New York State Trooper. I grew up in Capital District, New York State, right outside of Albany in Rotterdam, and always wanted to be a cop. And took a bunch of different tests and got called by the troopers back in 96. It probably started, right? Came on in 97 and had a great career. Did a lot of stuff in uniform. Got appointed to the BCI, which is the Bureau of Criminal Investigation. Had about 7 years on, became an investigator, worked in a bunch of different units, back rooms, which is basically like the plainclothes detective branch of every state police station, where you handle the more serious cases, felonies and child abuse, sex abuse cases, stuff like that. Did some time in computer crimes investigation as well. Back out to the field again, then a couple of years at Troop G Major Crimes right here in the Capital District in New York State. And the last 5 or 6 years, 6 years or so, I was at the academy, and when I started my career, you know, I never would have thought I wanted to go back there, but it turned out to be one of the greatest things I ever did. I really feel like it made a difference, and I retired as the senior investigator at the academy in charge of training for the BCI. So there's about 1,100 investigators in New York State Police, and I was in charge of coordinating, facilitating, presenting some of it, but basically getting all the training for the guys and girls and as the investigators in the state police, getting them in service training. Also did stuff with the recruits, did stuff for civilian employees, did stuff for their agencies. And part of it was I was a hostage negotiator, crisis negotiator since 2006. And at the academy, one of my roles encompassed that of being the division coordinator for the New York State Police crisis negotiation program. So I ran all the in-service training, we put together the new classes. We took the FBI class that I took back in 2006. We pulled it apart, put it back together, made it so it was still compatible and certifiable. And we put some other stuff in it. And, you know, we turned it into some of the best training that we ever did in the state police. And as such, you know, that kind of became one of my passions, being a negotiator, talking to people. I've always liked doing good interviews, just, you know, talking to people, building that rapport. Nothing like getting a confession, right? I mean, you know, for somebody to tell you something that they've done that's going to adversely affect them, send them to jail for the rest of their life, to get them to talk to you about that, some of their deepest, darkest secrets. It's just an incredible feeling when you can accomplish that. And same thing with crisis negotiation, crisis intervention, de-escalation, whatever you want to call it. It's all about talking to people. And, you know, if you can either save a life or you can lock somebody up by doing that, you know, you've done your job and you'd be real proud of it. So I was in charge of putting together some programs for de-escalation crisis intervention for the state police. You know, this year I decided, you know what, I got my numbers and I did 24 and a half years with the state police. By the time my sick leave is at the end, I'll have 25 years of my pension. So it's a nice number to go at, I think. And here I am. I'm retired for a couple months now and started my own small business here up near Saratoga, New York, called 886 Consulting. And, you know, my goal is to go out and teach schools and other agencies, you know, churches and things like that, stuff about de-escalation, how that can help them, not just the police, stuff about behavioral awareness, you know, active shooter awareness, prevention, things like that. So it's only been 2 months, but let me tell you, retirement does not suck, man. Does not suck at all.
There's a lot of things, I guess, that come with it that are good. And as long as you keep your mind busy.
Exactly.
And going. Yes. That's what, well, you don't want to be there being a fucking potato on a couch, you know?
No, exactly. You know, that's one of the things my wife said. She says, you're 52. You got to do something. You can't just stay home. So And I'd be bored just doing nothing anyway. So I'm happy to be doing this.
I'm quite convinced I'm going to work till I'm 85. I actually told my son that the other day.
Okay.
I said, I'm going to work till I'm 85. He's like, well, that's crazy. That's
it is, but hey, man, you know, some people are just wired that way. So it's not a bad thing, really.
I really believe that. I just enjoy work so much. Mm-hmm. I enjoy being productive and productivity that, you know, I've said this before on the podcast and people who know me know this best, that if you brought me to Cabo San Lucas and you said, we're going to hang on the beach for 6 days and drink margaritas, I would leave. I would go the fuck home.
Yeah. 6 days, that'd be too long. Like I can't sit still. Yeah.
Even when I'm home, I'm like, all right, there's things to do around here.
Mm-hmm.
Let me sit.
Yeah, there's always something to do. And believe me, I'm keeping myself busy and it's great. You know, I got a couple of little part-time gigs set up. I've got some teaching stuff coming up. I've got a ton of hobbies. It's funny, when I retired, my friends at the Academy for a retirement present, I don't play guitar. I'm a big heavy metal guy from the 80s. And they got me a guitar signed by the band Iron Maiden. So I put it on the wall. I kept looking at it. And I said, you know, I got to learn how to play this thing now that I'm retired. But I didn't want to use that one that they gave me. So, you know, just last week I went out, bought a new guitar, and I've been taking lessons online and stuff and loving it. So there's always something to do, man. Always something to do.
There's a TED Talk I watched. It was Learn Anything in 20 Hours. Okay. So, and the guy showed how he played the ukulele, how he learned how to play the ukulele in 20 hours. That would be a good one to watch if you're picking up the guitar. And essentially what he broke it down to was, knowing what the most important things to know about this instrument is will show you how to play it. Okay. And he said, once he mastered five chords, those five chords accounted for like 80% of all songs with the ukulele. So as long as you know those five chords, you could follow it. So learning the five chords, breaking it down, dissecting it. And he said, anything you want to do, you can learn in 20 hours and actually almost master in 20 hours.
Really?
So I would look at that video.
Yeah, I'll definitely take a look at that.
So how did you get into hostage negotiating? And again, I know that we're going to probably do this a few times.
Sure.
So we'll start with that.
I was an investigator, started as an investigator in 2004. And 2006, the FBI offered the course in Albany at the State Police Academy. And I asked my boss at the time, I said, hey, you know, I want to sign up for this. And put my name in for it. I got picked and attended the class and liked it. You know, within, I think, a week or two, I was driving back from a vehicle relay or something, and they had a guy in the street, mentally disturbed guy in the street, emotionally disturbed, an individual in crisis. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. We didn't have that saying for it back then, an individual in crisis, but we had somebody who, just wasn't following commands. He wasn't necessarily really a danger to himself or anybody else other than the fact that he was in the street. And, you know, I pulled up alongside with the deputy who was there, and I just started talking to him, and, you know, we basically talked him into the car and going to get help. And it was the stuff that I learned in the hostage negotiator class, the act of listening, the, you know, using empathy, doing all these things to talk to somebody to effectively have that behavioral change in that person. And I said, you know what, this is right along the lines of interviewing a bad guy and getting that confession. Like I said before, it's talking to people and using empathy and building that rapport and coming to a good solution with things. You know, that being said, does it always come to a good solution? No, I've been at incidents where, the individual has killed themselves. You know, de-escalation is an outcome. It's not a tactic. And the outcome is heavily influenced by that individual that you're dealing with. Because, you know, you hear de-escalation, you hear hostage negotiation or crisis negotiation. And I think a lot of officers, you know, they feel like, oh, Christ, here we go again with more touchy-feely woke stuff, where we're just going to talk about things, you know, we're going to talk to people and talk about their feelings. Well, yeah, if we can talk to somebody, we're gonna, because I'd rather talk to somebody for 4 hours than roll around with somebody for 4 seconds on the side of the road. I've done both, but if you can talk to somebody, you're definitely going to increase your chances of you and the other person, anybody else coming out unhurt. That being said though, if the individual you're dealing with presents an immediate threat, you may end up quickly resorting to the use of deadly physical force to de-escalate that situation. So use of force is certainly part of de-escalation as well, not just the verbal aspect of it. So it's certainly not soft policing. It's not anything that some people are concerned it may be.
What was the common ground, or what allowed you to communicate with that person in the first story?
He just kind of wanted to vent about, we're going back almost 20 years here now. You know, I just remember that it was the other officer that was talking to him initially wasn't giving him a chance to talk at all, wasn't giving him a chance to vent, wasn't giving him a chance to, unload what he needed to unload. And if you just take that little bit extra time, you talk to somebody, you know, you don't have to agree with them. You don't have to like that person. You don't have to, you're certainly not going to condone what they're doing if they're doing something illegal, but just getting to let that person vent a little bit, letting them go ahead and express their emotions and having you understand their emotions goes a long way with people and affects that behavioral change. And I think that's what ended up happening. And then as time gone has, you know, had gone on, I had gone to more serious calls, you know, on the call outs where, you know, you'd have somebody barricaded. I was never in a real hostage situation. Those are far and few between. We did have one or two in New York State last year or two, different troops than me, but that's kind of a misnomer most of the time. And that's why we actually in the state police change it from hostage negotiation to crisis negotiation, because the amount of hostage incidents are very limited. But you're going to use the same principles to talk somebody down.
What makes somebody a good communicator? What's one of those things that where somebody's, you've maybe even seen them in your training courses where they're very natural at being able to talk to somebody?
Well, you know, yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head there too by saying natural. You know, not everybody has it. It's something that you can learn, but I think it starts with listening. You know, listening is actually our least developed skill. And we spend most of our time listening to things. And there's a difference between hearing and listening. You know, hearing is just the reception of sound, right? But if you're listening, you're getting that sound, you're hearing that sound come in, but you're also putting it into words and emotions, and you're able to communicate with that once you listen. We spend most of our day communicating, right? We all want to talk, we all want to be heard. And the best communicators actually slow down sometimes and they let other people talk and they listen. So to be a good negotiator, to be good at verbal de-escalation, I think you have to be a good communicator. You have to be a good listener. You have to be able to empathize with people, you know, use active listening to understand where that person's coming from, understand their emotion. You know, one of the things that people make a mistake a lot, I think, when they try to talk to somebody, you know, say, I understand what you're going through. No, man, no, you don't. You don't understand what I'm going through at all. And there's no way you can understand exactly what the other person is going through. You can understand their emotion. You can understand that they're upset about something and you may recognize the reason why they're upset, but you can't understand what they're feeling because you're not actually in their shoes. And what is a problem to me might be nothing for somebody else. And what is so serious to somebody else might be nothing to me, right? I mean, how many times did you go to a call where, you know, the person that you're dealing with, you're complaining, it was like the end of the world to them, right? And you're like, are you fucking kidding me? This is nothing. But do you come out and say that? No, you're going to provide that person with the best service you can. And, you know, I always told the recruits and told my, you know, students, my classes that, you know, and I actually got this from the guy who whose position I took. He had said it. The good people of the state will call the police but once in their life. All right. And you need to treat that person with the best respect. Treat them how you would want your family treated if they called, even if it was something very trivial to you. Because for them to go ahead and be calling the police, it's obviously something that's very, very big to them. And as a good communicator, as a good negotiator, as a good de-escalator, I don't know if that's a word, if you're good at using de-escalation, you want to be a good communicator. You want to understand that emotion and you want to be able to relate to the people. And
I believe a lot of that can be learned. I really do.
Absolutely. I think there's a little bit of it that, you know, you come with, but as police officers, we all should be good communicators anyway. That's our bread and butter, right? You know, we've got the car, we've got the gun, we got the vest, but what are we using the most? Our mouths. We're talking to people. Okay. We've got our defensive tactics. We've got all the other tools in our toolbox, but we're using our mouths the most. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, by the time you get to the point where you're in law enforcement, hopefully you have enough life experiences where you're used to have been talking to people. And, you know, I think it's changed a little bit now with the younger generation and everything is texting, and that's how a lot of people communicate. So that's one of the struggles that we're having in training now is getting people around that. But yeah, you can definitely teach it to people. And that's one of the things we did is we rolled out a couple of classes to actually teach it to not just our specialized hostage negotiators that are investigators in the state police, but so that every trooper, investigator, sergeant, lieutenant, everybody who's sworn up through the rank of major had training in crisis intervention and then had training in de-escalation.
You think the training was effective?
Yes, I do, because I heard actually right from some people who would email me directly and say, hey, Jeff, you know, this program was good. I learned a couple of things. We had an incident where, you know, somebody could have been tased right away, but it was a safe enough situation. where they had taser coverage, they had lethal coverage. They were actually able to talk to the person a couple more minutes and avoided any use of force. And they did that by, they said, you know, by using some of the active listening skills that they had gotten from the program.
When you say listening, I hear being patient. And I think a lot of times law enforcement, including myself, we're fixers. So we're quick to resolve the issue. We have other things to do. We got pending calls, stuff's backed up. What do you think the significance of patience plays, or the role it plays in being able to communicate or de-escalate a situation?
Patience is very important. Yeah, you got to have it. If you don't have the patience, you run the risk of creating officer-induced jeopardy. And that's when, as an officer or another officer goes ahead and maybe doesn't have patience and turns a situation where you have that communication between you and that other individual, but you're like, you know what, I got to wrap this up soon. It's the end of my tour. Like you said, I got jobs stacked up. I got to get home, get the kids to soccer practice, whatever you have. So you rush it. Now you've gone ahead and you rushed it and you've said the wrong thing that just sets that person off. And you've created that jeopardy there now that's escalated the situation instead of de-escalating it. And it then has the potential to go ahead and turn into an immediate threat. And when I see immediate threat, that's where, hey, you know what? All bets are off. We've got to do whatever we need to do to get home that night. Mm-hmm. So now the person's coming at you with a knife. Now the person has, you know, somehow gotten through your cover, has gotten through your backup, and now they're coming at you. So we need to deal with that with whatever use of force is now appropriate.
When you guys taught recruits, what did that look like and how did they fail and succeed?
With the recruits, what we did was we first rolled out a program that was 2 hours. That was our crisis intervention program. And it was at the end of their 6 months of training at the academy. So it actually worked out pretty good because they had gotten a lot of these skills that we talked about, the active listening, showing of empathy, building rapport, listening, patience. They had already started to develop that through other modules that they had gone through as recruits. So it was great that it was at the end because it kind of put the pieces together. I think that it helped them. I didn't hear anything specifically from recruits. We got great critiques from it with, you know, good comments. You know, you can do a critique after a class where you circle 1 to 5, right? You know, 5 being very good, 1 being not good. And that doesn't mean shit. You know, you've got to have some type of actual constructive criticism or a comment about something specific that was good for it to make any sense. And we got a lot from the recruits that they thought it would help them in their communication skills out in the field. They thought it would help them relate to people in the field and as far as understanding the emotions that somebody in distress or somebody in crisis was feeling. So they actually got back with a couple of the key words like that, that made me feel like, okay, you know, we did our job with that. It wasn't just a filler at the end of the class.
Mm-hmm. Which is like 84% of the academy.
Right.
Unfortunately, right. We're trying to fix that.
Yeah, oh yes, we are. And, you know, and more unfortunately, one of the things for, when they get that, in what we call BCI week, and it's at the end of the class and, you know, they're not graded on it at that point and they're just ready to get the hell out, man. They want to just get in the bag and go out there and be on the road. So
yeah,
that's tough.
Yeah, you get that eagerness at the end.
Right.
What were you guys actually running, like practical scenarios with the recruits, having actors, things like that?
We didn't, in particular with this particular program, throughout the course of their 6 months there though, they do have scenarios. And like I said, they kind of take the components of those and they put it together with what we taught them at the end and it was successful. So throughout the whole class, they'll have, most of the time, it's just, unfortunately, it's people that they're used to dealing with at the academy. But they do a lot of reality-based training, a lot of reality-based training scenarios where they incorporate a lot of this stuff. When we run our classes for our investigators, we'll go ahead and we'll do scenarios and we'll take things from the headlines, basically, things that are common out there now, and we'll, you know, we'll put them into that situation. We actually just did a advanced crisis negotiation course as a pilot at the State Training Center in Erskine, New York, which is out near Utica. And we invited agencies from basically all over the state to come participate as this pilot program. And it was put on by Division of Homeland Security. And myself and, you know, officers from other agencies put up the scenarios together and kind of the curriculum for it. We used a lifelike training setting. At this training center, they have basically a city built inside. So we use that. We use some scenarios that were kind of ripped right from the headlines and threw people right into it and used the actors, basically. This training center has actors. We also brought in our crisis negotiators who people didn't know, and we had them be the actors in it. So yeah, the scenario training is definitely something that we is really key to this stuff to be successful.
Do you have in your mind, maybe off the cuff here, videos that you could refer people to on great de-escalation examples, maybe a body-worn camera, and ones that were horrific? Is there anything that comes to your mind? If not, you could just defer. We can move to the next question.
There's one video that I like to use in my classes, and it was it's on YouTube. It's publicly available, and it's a good demonstration of an immediate threat. There's actually several of them, but this one was actually put out by Lancaster City Police in the state of Pennsylvania. Basically, what it is, it's body-worn camera footage of an officer who comes into that immediate threat. And Manchester City Police in Pennsylvania. And it's officer-involved shooting. And basically what happens is the officer walks up to a complaint. And it's on a city street, and he's got to go up a couple steps to get to the front door. Just as he gets there, a male subject comes right out the front door, knife in his hand, and swings it at the officer, attacks him. Officer shoots him, kills him. And there's no chance for anything else to happen. And it's an example of an immediate threat that the officer dealt with. So that's how he was able to de-escalate the situation, you know, not getting into any of the legalities of it or, you know, any of their policy procedures, anything like that. But it's an example of how de-escalation works, you know, with not the best outcome, because, you know, none of us get into this position where we want to kill somebody. But so unfortunately, sometimes that was what we have to do to go home. Mm-hmm. So as far as any of actual, you know, in the state police, it's very hard to watch, to obtain the body worn camera footage for training purposes. We just started using them last year or the year before.
I know the first time we talked, I brought up the Chris Voss book, Never Split the Difference. Have you read that book?
No, I have not.
Okay. So he was one of the top FBI negotiators. And he wrote a book. He now runs a group called the Black Swan Group. He was a Kansas City cop turned FBI negotiator. Crazy, crazy stuff. International rescues. Really good stuff. I implore everybody, you know, the only reason I am an advocate for it, because I listened to it three times. I'm an audio listener. Mm-hmm. Hence why I'm in podcasts and audiobooks. I think because I could do two things at once. So I work out and listen to books. As nuts as that sounds, that's my thing. But this book is, I mean, it's excellent. I really think that everybody should listen to it or buy it or read it. It's very rare that I pick up a article or periodical or I don't know, say periodical or a book. And look at me trying to sound smart there for a second. See, I just stay in my fucking space. Pick up a book and go through it three times over. There's probably only five books in my life, and I'm a book junkie for the past 7-8 years, that I've actually listened to that many times. Wow. Because there's so many valuable lessons in there about how to communicate. So you could even go online and watch some of his YouTube videos. You know, I always try to implore people to seek what they're looking to find. You'd be surprised. Absolutely. When you just start looking.
There's so many TED Talks out there. There's so many different. Yeah, I've gone through YouTube videos when I was at the academy looking for stuff to put into, you know, presentations and little snippets here and there to pull out. There's nothing that stands out with me, unfortunately.
When you talk, sometimes I hear we have mental health professionals who have been a part of this program. I have been to therapy sessions myself, and I think I'm a little sharp, and I often hear the techniques that these people employ on how they communicate with people. So it's never judgment is a big one.
Right.
One key to a great therapist or a great mental health professional is releasing judgment. And I think we see that in a lot of interviews with these horrendous people who have committed these heinous acts.
Sure.
But it feels like they kind of let their guard down and open up when they feel like they're not being judged on their actions. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's extremely important. We don't want to act like we're judging them. We want to show them that we get where they're coming from. We understand that emotion. Again, we don't understand exactly what they're going through, but if we're going to sit there and judge them for this, if we're going to sit there and berate them for this, they're not going to talk to us. It's like you said, it's like when you talk to somebody who's committed that heinous crime. And, you know, I've had a couple of times where I wanted to burn a suit after I talked to somebody because, you know, I talked to that child molester, that rapist, that, you know, and gave him a hug, you know, after they've gone ahead and made an admission or a confession. And, you know, you just have to, you have to let that go. You have to be professional about it. And, you know, there'll be a time for their judgment down the road. And a lot of times with these people who are in crisis, who that we're dealing with, they may not have committed a crime. They may just, they're having a bad day in one way or another. And sometimes they just need somebody to listen to them. And again, that's where that patience comes in. That's where that building rapport comes in. And I think, again, I think I like it because it relates back to, you know, when you're in the room with somebody, when you're sitting down with somebody and you're conducting a good interview, you know, you're getting to know that person and you got to have the time too. You got to put the time into it because again, it goes back to that patience. If you're rushed and you sit down in a room with somebody, try to get a confession, what happens, right? They see you're pressed for time and boom, you've lost. So same thing with de-escalation, negotiations, whatever you want to call it, crisis intervention. You got to have that patience. Can't be judgmental. All right. You've got to show that empathy, right? We don't want to show sympathy. And I think sometimes a lot of people get sympathy and empathy mixed up, right? We don't want to feel sorry for somebody. We don't want to take on their problems either, right? I got enough of my own problems. That's for sure. I don't need somebody else's, but you got to be empathetic about it. And you've got to just, be there for that person, as cliche and stupid as that sounds. If you're there for that person, you develop that rapport, you're not judgmental, you're going to get through to them. The chances of getting through to them are better. And again, this doesn't always work. You're going to have some people who, for whatever reason, you just can't talk to. Or maybe they're not going to talk to me today, but they'll talk to you. And then the next time around, it's going to be vice versa. And again, if you're not judgmental, if you're not harsh to that person, they're going to remember that too. Because what happens with a lot of these incidents? What do we do? We're going back to see him again because, you know, next week we're going to get another call on this person because they're going to do the same thing. And if they remember that we treated them with fairness and with dignity and empathy, it's going to be a lot easier for the next person who has to come to deal with them because it might not be you, it might be somebody else. And if they remember that the last person was an asshole to them, it's going to be that much harder for the next person to go deal with them. And, that's something I ran into a lot where I'm not coming out because last time it came out, this, other agency SWAT team took me to the ground and beat the shit out of me. And okay, well now I got to start at square one and explain that's not going to happen. I'm sorry that happened. I don't know that agency. I can tell you that's not the way we do business here. I never worked here before. I never dealt with you before. So, you know, please give me a chance to start over. Again, it's that rapport building, not judging.
A lot of police officers listening to this podcast, probably eager to hear maybe some practical advice as they are working at the moment or going to their next shift. What can we do right now via podcast that can help us be better and maybe giving a few pieces of advice outside of the stuff we've already discussed about empathy, patience, compassion? What are some things that we need to know to maybe stay alive, keep others alive, or if we're encountering a situation where we're trying to de-escalate, you know, what are some things you can practically give to an officer to use right now?
Well, it's funny because a lot of the things that we already talked about and that I'll talk about right now should be being a cop 101, right? But we'll go over it anyway. And that is, you know, we've got to assess the situation first. So that's going to start right from your radio call or your phone call to the station, whatever. And it's going to be officer safety, number one, right? We're going to assess the situation. We're going to get there. And you've got to put the three C's to work. Three C's are contain, control, and communicate, right? We got to contain that scene. Even if it's just you on your own, you got to keep other people away, maybe get the family out of the house, assess the situation. You know, you want to use distance, you want to use cover, concealment. You may have to move around from one position to another, depending on what that person's doing. But you want to contain that scene the best you can until you can get other people there and have them work on that. And then you can specifically work on dealing with that individual. Controlling the scene. What's the only thing that we can really control in any call we go on? Ourselves, right? That's really the only thing you have complete control over. But if you can contain the situation, if you can establish that rapport, do all those things we already talked about, you're starting to get a little bit in control of that situation. And remember that you want to be in control of yourself and not out of control, okay? And that's where that patience comes into. That's where that officer-induced jeopardy comes in. Being in control of yourself and controlling your own emotions is going to be very important. Because in de-escalation, what are we trying to do? We're trying to lower somebody's emotions, right? Somebody's in a crisis, their emotions are way up here, right? And where's their rationality? Way down here. So in de-escalation, we're trying to balance out those emotions. We're trying to bring their emotions down. We're trying to bring their rationality up to get them to a normal level of functioning, right? By establishing that control, we can go ahead and we can start to do that by using the behavioral change staircase, active listening, empathy, rapport, and get to that influencing that behavioral change that we're looking for. Finally, communication. It's all about communication, okay? It's all about being that good listener, having a good opening line with that person. And it shouldn't be just charged right in there. You know, I'm Officer So-and-so, get your hands in the air, get down on the ground, that kind of stuff. You know, start out as a person to person. People are going to react to that better. My thing was always, I'm Jeff. I'm here because we were called for something. What can I do to help you? All right. Make them kind of feel like the ball's in their court with that. You're still in control, but depending on how you talk to that person, how you communicate, you know, you give them a little bit of a rope there to kind of like feel like they're in control of things a little bit. You're there to help them. That way they're telling you what they need for help. That's going to go a long way. Again, does it always work? No, it doesn't. There's sometimes where you're just going to have to go in there and you're going to have to go hands-on right away. You're going to have to go to whatever level of force in your use of force continuum that you're at that particular time. But we have a duty as police officers to go ahead and try to resolve the situation without the use of force initially, if we have to. And that was established way back in the 70s with Downs versus U.S. You feel familiar with that case?
States. Give me a little bit of context on it. I'll probably.
Sure. So what happened with that one? There was a hijacking. A guy hijacked a plane, took his wife as a hostage, right? He wanted to go to Cuba. Long story short, they land in Florida. The FBI is there, right? Yep. So what does the FBI?
Oh, and this is where they sued the shit out of the United States.
Yes, exactly.
This whole thing up.
Yeah,
so Voss talks about this in his book.
Okay, great. Yep. And that's what established for hostage negotiations. And since de-escalation uses the same tenets of hostage negotiation, you know, we can relate back to Downs versus US for our responsibility there to go ahead and, you know, as the police, we have to exercise that care. Not to hurt anybody, not to use force unless we can make a good, a good faith effort at communication first. But the court, which is good, the court did recognize that, hey, there can be emergencies, there can be situations where you're not going to have a chance to do this. So they're not saying that, hey, the guy's coming at you with a knife, the guy has a gun, you've got to try to talk to him first. No, they recognize that there's that imminent threat, there's that immediate threat that you're going to have to take care of. But absent that, and that's what happened in this case, they had communication, they had dialogue with the person with the hijacker on the plane, but the FBI decided to shoot out the tires of the plane, figuring that it can't go anywhere. So they've got them. So once they started shooting, then they heard gunshots from inside the plane. They shot the engine. They stormed the plane. They found the pilot dead. They found the guy's wife dead. And then they found the hijacker with a gunshot wound to the head. He eventually died too. So it was the pilot's wife and the hostage's family who sued the government. And they actually got very, very low amounts of money from the government at that point, which was pretty sad. But that's what set in motion that we've got to go ahead and we've got to try to make that communication first.
Earlier, you said when you went to a place, you introduced yourself as Jeff. What is the psychology or the tactic behind introducing yourself as Jeff, not Trooper Scholes?
Yeah, it's puts you on a more personal level, as opposed to walking in there and saying, I'm Trooper Scholes with New York State Police, or I'm Senior Investigator Scholes with New York State Police. You're going to listen to me right now. Doesn't it sound better if, you introduce, hey, I'm Jeff, get rid of that title, get rid of that authority figure. You're still the authority. Don't get me wrong. That's your show. You're going to be in control of it. You're going to use whatever force you need to use, but that's going to be dictated by the actions of that individual that you're dealing with. But if you take out that authority sounding stuff right there, you're going to be there more just to help somebody rather than using that authoritative title or rank or whatever, what have you at that point.
That's actually another thing that Voss talks about in his book. And I hate to make this about the Chris Voss show, but it is a thing that I think a lot of people, maybe as police officers, are trying to conceal their identity and they want anonymity. They're very apprehensive to say their first names. What would you say to cops who feel that way?
I see where that's coming from, especially with everybody being on YouTube now and, your First Amendment auditors or whatever you call them now that are going around with cameras and trying to do stuff. Really, if they file a FOIL request with your agency and they find out about it, they're going to get your full name anyway. So, you got to lose that for lack of a better word, you got to lose that ego, I guess. And you know what? I remember being a young trooper and somebody asked me, what's your name? And, you know, I'm like, Trooper Scholes. What's your first name? Trooper. No, you know, it's not, you know, I'm a person, you're a person. It's at the end of the day, you know, we're doing a job here and we all take it very personal, and we should, especially when we're dealing with life and death situations. And we've been instances where we've been hurt, our friends have been hurt or killed. It's hard to break down that barrier sometimes with the public, but when you're dealing with somebody who's in crisis and you want to get through to that person, part of that empathy, part of that rapport building is, hey, I'm Jeff. And in major crimes or in any other situation, I walk into a room to interview somebody. Hey, I'm Jeff with the state police. I want to put that person at ease, develop that rapport. I'll talk to somebody for 2 hours about, you know, a 57 Chevy that's in their driveway. I know nothing about cars, but I'll walk up, and if I'm going to talk to you about something, I want to find that common, non-threatening ground, right? And if it's something that's important to you, it's going to be important to me. So I'll let you talk about that 57 Chevy for 2 hours, and I'll just make it seem like it's the most interesting thing in the world to me, but I could really give a shit. But if it helps develop that rapport and gets me talking, gets you talking with me, breaks down that barrier, chances of me changing your behavior or getting you to tell me what I want you to tell me is going to be that much easier for me.
How about 1 to 3 memorable jobs in your career, whether good or bad, maybe something you're proud of, maybe something you're not proud of. But after a 25-year career at the New York State Police and all the things that you've done, it could be something as simple as connecting with somebody you worked with, or, you know, really it's your choice.
One job I remember, one negotiation I remember, there's actually a couple funny things that happened with this one. And it was a good resolution. The guy ended up coming out at the end, but it was in the middle of nowhere. You know, state police, we pretty much patrol the middle of nowhere. So it's on this back county road, and I end up responding, and it's probably about 35 minutes from my house. And as I'm getting there, I end up driving right past the house where the guy's inside with the gun, which we don't want to do, right? But it just so happened. I went down the road. Nobody was there to tell me differently. Pull up by the command post, which is down the road a little bit. They tell me I did. I'm like, well, shit, thanks for telling me. But anyway, I end up talking to this guy on the phone at first. At the time, we had like this old bread truck that they painted blue and gold, which was our negotiation center, right? So that comes down the road, and this thing literally looks like it's out of the 70s show SWAT. And that's what the guy thought it was. He saw that drive past the house and he starts yelling at me on the phone, like, you're sending the fucking SWAT team here, blah, blah, blah. This is bullshit. And he starts yelling at me. And I'm like, look, that's not the SWAT team. And we call it SORT, or Special Operations Team, Special Operations Response Team. And it turns out, you know, SORT is on en route too, but they're not in this truck. This is somebody brought the negotiation van from one of the stations where it was kept at headquarters. And I'm going back and forth with them. And finally, I'm like, listen, man, I'm not going to lie to you. SWAT team's coming, and they're coming in a fucking tank. You're going to know it when you see it. And that kind of brought the guy down just a little bit. So SORT shows up with the Bearcat. I get in the Bearcat to drive up into the driveway and talk to this guy through the phone there. And then he stops answering. So we're using the PA. We're doing loud calls to him. And we lose kind of contact with him for a little bit. So one of the officers makes the decision for SORT to go ahead and shoot a beanbag through one of his garage windows, see if we can get a reaction from him. So they do that. And just a short time before that, when he was talking to us, you know, this was the end of the world, whatever problem it was that he was having was the worst thing that could possibly happen. And nothing was worth living for. And you should have seen the behavioral change when they broke that window. All that got forgotten. And all this guy cared about was his broken window. Now that's all he went on about was his broken window.
That's funny.
So he ends up coming out a little bit later on. I talked about it. I walked him through the whole surrender phase saying, listen, you know, our SWAT guys are going to be out there. They're dressed in green. They're dressed in camo, whatever it was back at the time. They've got long guns. You're just going to listen to them. And this was one of the guys who said, no, I'm not going to come out. You know, I got lumped up last time. Listen, that's not going to happen. They're going to walk you through exactly what to do. Follow their instructions. Nothing will happen. I'm going to come out and shake your hand afterwards. So he comes out, follows the instructions. They put him on the ground. They cuff him up. Nobody's hurt. Nobody's even dusty or anything. I come out, I actually walked out to him, introduced myself, and he thanked me. So that was a good one. Another one.
What was he thankful for?
He was thankful for the fact that I didn't lie to him and he didn't get hurt. So he was taken off. He was an MHL, and took him off to the hospital. And I think he was released not long after that.
But 3 hours after he's gone. You know what I mean?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. So not quite as bad as...
Jeff, the cops are a problem, you know. The mental health issues and crisis centers that we have that literally make people sit in tanks for fucking 15 hours where they see some mope who's just a doctor comes in and goes, yeah, what do you think? nothing we can do with them. We can't keep them. Right. Send them all. You know, like it's, and then it's blamed back to the cops.
Right.
But you did, actually did fault, a good job there.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Another one I remember is another one didn't have as quite as good an ending. Not a good ending for the individual involved. He ended up killing himself. But we established a dialogue with him. Me and another investigator were in the Bearcat. I was the secondary on this one. He ended up coming up, opened the front door to talk to us. And he had been threatening to shoot himself. And he opened up the front door and he was bleeding from the face. And we didn't hear a shot or anything. And I said, I don't think he shot himself. I think he fell down the stairs or something because he was drunk too. And it turns out he shot himself, but flinched and just took his nose off. We found out afterwards with a .22 rifle. Wow. And then he ended up firing a shot out the window that one of the SWAT guys saw hit off to the side. The response was very restrained. You know, there was no return fire into the house, which was good. But then they used gas. So they gassed the house. And one thing I always tell everybody in my classes now is if you're going to go in the Bearcat, don't forget your gas mask. We didn't have our gas mask with us. Luckily, nothing came back into it, but they were busting our balls pretty good because we didn't have gas masks. And they're like, you can't get out. You're not getting out. You're stuck in here if it comes in. Luckily, didn't come back in. Later on, they sent a robot in and they found the individual deceased at the top of the stairs. He had shot himself again. So it, you know, we had established a dialogue with him on and off, but he just didn't want to come out. He didn't listen. And unfortunately, you know, that's what happened with that one. Yeah. You know, an unfortunate ending for that individual. I don't remember what he was in crisis over at this point, but unfortunately, you know, that's the way it works out sometimes, I guess. Another instance, I remember I was a young trooper and got a call for, and I'm sure a lot of people got calls just like this, naked guy walking down the road. Shit. So it's my post. I end up going, sure enough, there's this guy walking down the side of the road. He's got his clothes tucked under his arm and he is just walking. So I light him up as I come up, I spotlight him and he just looks at me and keeps walking, right? So I put the car in reverse. I'm kind of just going along this way and then turning a little bit. So he kind of has to stop. I get out of the car. I'm talking to him using the same stuff, just trying to communicate with him. Finally, I convince him to put at least his underwear on. So he puts his boxers on. And I'm telling you, he had his clothes folded up all nice. He was a drunk. He was drunk. He was, you know, probably in his 20s or something. The funny thing about this one, though, I was working with that night on the other post was a female trooper. And she was in a post far away, but she had radioed that she would be coming to back me up. You know, naked guy in the road. And let me tell you, brother, she was coming down 600 miles an hour, lights and sirens to this thing, the end of the road, you know, and then she gets there and he's got his shorts on. So she's like, oh, you couldn't have waited just a couple more minutes. And I'm like, yeah, you're not, don't get me going. But you know, just talk to you like, hey, listen, you know, you got to get dressed. You can't do this. He's just, nope. This feels good. I'm like, look, okay. Tell you what, do a little something for me. Put your underwear on. Okay. So he puts his boxers on. So, you know, it was just a little thing like that. Okay. Get in the car. Let's get you a ride somewhere. So we brought him to the hospital, checked him in there. Again, I think it was just because he was drunk. But again, it was just, you know, taking that few minutes to talk to somebody instead of, you know, wouldn't you rather talk to somebody for, you know, 10 minutes if you have to, rather than rolling around with a sweaty naked guy on the side of the road in the summer? Absolutely.
I know. I would.
So, you know,
I can't speak for everybody. It might be somebody listening going, nah, that sounds,
hey,
not too,
you know,
bad.
Whatever. You be you, right? That's the way I look at it. But, you know, hot summer night, any night, actually, you know, rather than with his clothes or not, I'd rather talk to somebody. If you got to go hands on, you got to go hands on. But take that few minutes, talk to somebody, and they're going to remember that too. Hopefully, you know, they're going to remember that the next time it happens. Like, okay, I remember the last guy that, you know, the last guy I talked to, he treated me well, rather than the guy before who was like, no, I got lumped up last time. I don't want to come out and make it that much more difficult. So it's all about communication, man. It's all about connecting with people and, you know, trying to keep yourself and them as safe as you can.
Tell me what you think about this one. This sparked a story in my mind and I tell it sometimes and it, usually I get on a tear and I've got some real good stories, some funny stuff. Cause I had some real funny partners. And at some point, every partnership I had, my goal was to just make them laugh, mm-hmm. whether it was inappropriate or appropriate, but that became reciprocal. So it was right. A constant war to try to make each other laugh on scenes and stops and stuff like that. I'm talking like, you know, barking out the window And I'm like, Tom, there's a canine. And he's like, try not to laugh at the window, like things like that, you know, before cameras. I'm not advocating people do that now. It's a little unprofessional, but it was funny. Right. It was harmless fun. And we had a call. Guy calls dispatch, says he's going to kill himself. So he's at a hotel. I won't talk about who my partner was. A unique character at that. And, you know, we go to this hotel and he's on the phone with dispatch. They're giving us the information as they're talking to him. And, you know, he won't open the door. So we got to get the maintenance guy at the hotel to come. And so we get into the room. Here he is laying on the bed. And, you know, I don't think that we did a great job of negotiating, but he's laying on the bed. I don't forget the sheets being soiled. Nothing crazy, just some stains in the sheets. And we're like, well, look, dude, you know, you got to go to the hospital. We don't want to fight with you. You got to go. You can't say this stuff. And it just is what it is. But then my partner, I guess he was to share this hotel room with a girlfriend or something. So like, come on, bud, let's get you dressed. So he starts dressing him in the woman's clothes. So the guy's like took pills and he was drinking. So he starts taking like this pink, like tube top. He's sliding on him like spaghetti straps. Now the fucking EMTs are hysterical. I can't breathe. Then this dude starts dying laughing. Now he's cracking up. And he's like, you guys are fucked up. And he's like, no, put the shirt on.
Right.
My partner's actually getting the shirt on. He's like, come on, we're going to get you dressed. But this guy got such a kick out of it. It actually snapped him out of his whole stupor, sure. What he was in. And he was like, oh God, you guys are fucked up. And he's like laughing with us. He's like, all right, I'll go. Come on, let's go. You know, I find it very, that was one of my favorite stories. I mean, I couldn't breathe. I was crying. This guy wants
you guys made a connection with him, man. You know, it worked, right?
It broke the ice, man. And yeah, like, here he is. Sometimes I'll never be that pink. Yeah. Oh, dude, it was so funny. He's like, this is not my shirt. And like, my partner's like, yeah, it is. It's your shirt. We found it. It's in your room. He's like, that's not mine. Come on, guys. Like, we're dressing in women's clothes. It was good.
That's good.
So that's one of my funny stories. But anyway, listen, this has been a great podcast episode. I think we've come up to our time limit here.
Okay.
Give another plug where people can find you and what your intentions are with Street Cop Training.
Yeah, I'd love to come on and do some stuff with you guys. It'd be great. Do some de-escalation training, do some behavioral awareness training, whatever you guys want. I'm on board with working for you. I love the stuff that you do. Follow you on Instagram and everything else, and good stuff. As far as what I'm doing here in New York, it's 886 Consulting. 886 was my shield number. So that's where I derived that from. And I have a website, 886consultingllc.com. And an email of 886consulting@gmail.com. So, you know, thanks again for having me on. I really appreciate it. I had a good time. And, you know, keep doing what you're doing, brother. It's great. And really appreciate it.
Guys, you heard it here. His class will be coming in the future. De-escalation, obviously a hot topic issue, but we're not doing it because it's a hot topic issue. We're doing it because it's an important issue. And we really do, as a law enforcement community, want to see there be less use of force issues or scenarios if we can actually reduce them. And contrary to popular belief or how the media portrays law enforcement, it is our goal to really do the right thing. Cops are really out there trying to do the right thing, and they're human beings, but this is one of those things that we're putting in a top priority. This will be the last time you see Jeff Scholes. Thank you all again for continuing to listen to the Street Cop Training Podcast. Have a good one. Hey guys, don't forget to check out the Street Cop Training Conference 2023, April 23rd through the 28th, Nashville, Tennessee, the Gaylord at Opry. What a center, what a place. We have amazing speakers, amazing training, 5 of the most impactful days of your career. Check it out at streetcop.com. You do not want to miss out. There is a room code available for a discounted room. Sign up now at streetcop.com.